another homework being returned. So, regrade request should be submitted today after class. And what does our calendar say? Do we have another exam coming up next week? Yeah, they keep coming. Yeah, every 2 weeks. But you know this structure, man. It's like this structure. Probably this exam is going to have a little bit lower mean. It will be a little bit harder. But I don't think it should be scary. And then there is a homework that's due tonight. No, not tonight, tomorrow. Today is Thursday. Sorry. Okay, today we're going to talk about continuity equations so that you can do the homework problem. We are almost there, okay? We have collected all these various equations which in totality make up Maxwell's equations. We already have now Faraday's law. We know that divergence of B is equal to zero. We had Gauss's law, and nobody found any reason why to change it as we move from DC to AC. That's gonna sort of stay there and be valid. Of course, that requires some experimental verification, but that was provided by Heinrich Hertz following Maxwell. The only thing that is missing so far is our Ampere's law is not in the best shape. Or our Ampere's law is incorrect, incomplete, so to speak. And Maxwell figured this out in around 1860. He changed the equation, he added a term, a displacement current term. And after that, the equations come alive. They predict the propagation of light. They predict propagation of electromagnetic waves with a speed that measures the speed of light. And all of a sudden, we have a unification of not only electricity with magnetism, but also with light. And there are some assumptions as Maxwell is writing these equations, but they are then confirmed in the lab. And these equations have been intact and serving us ever since, 1860s or so, mid-1860s. Okay, so but what Maxwell noticed there was this equation that he had, which was curl of H is equal to J. Something was funny about this equation. This equation was no good. It was sort of inconsistent with the most general form you can write charge conservation condition, continuity equation. Okay? If you take the divergence of H, divergence of curl of H, it has to be equal to zero, then it says divergence of J has to be equal to zero. But divergence of J doesn't have to be equal to zero all the time. In DC situation, it will be zero, but in AC situation, most likely it is not. Where do we see this from? We see this from continuity equation. This is the equation that you are playing with in your homework that's due tomorrow at 5, okay? So let's look at the continuity equation. And we have talked about this continuity equation in various ways, actually throughout the semester, but this is a time to sort of like once and for all make everything crystal clear. So let's consider a volume of space surrounded by sort of like defined by two surfaces, S1 and S2. And in between these two surfaces, I have a volume V. And I will assume that some current I1 is entering this volume through surface 1, and then some current I2 is exiting from this volume through surface 2, okay? Then I will wonder about I1 minus I2. Well, I would say that I1 minus I2 is equal to zero if there is no charge accumulating. If all the current coming in is getting out, but there's going to be no charge accumulation, and then I'm going to set this equal to zero. But suppose I1 is a bigger quantity than I2. Okay, by I1 and I2, now I'm not talking about current density, I'm talking about absolute current calculated over that entire surface. It's in amperes. So if I1 is 5 amperes and I2 is 3 amperes, then there is a difference of 2 amperes. And that amperes, 2 amperes, is a rate of accumulation of charge within this volume.
If what's coming in is not coming out, then it's staying there. Of course, unless there is a magical disappearance of charge. But charge is a quantity that doesn't magically disappear. Okay, conservation of charge goes hand in hand with the idea. Not only there is an equation that charge obeys that sort of relates the transport of charge to the rate of change of stored charge in a given volume, there is no other thing to consider. There is no creation of or disappearance of net charge in a given volume. Now this is a little bit different from another conserved quantity. We can talk about energy, we can talk about the transport of energy, we can talk about stored energy density, which we talked about last lecture, right? Total electromagnetic stored energy per unit volume is 1/2 epsilon E squared plus 1/2 mu H squared, okay? That quantity can be changing or going down as a function of time because of transport, but it can also change, even in the absence of transport, it can change because energy can be dissipated in a given volume or it can be created in a given volume. So there can be sinks or sources for conserved quantities. In a conservation equation for that particular quantity, you have to consider the sources and sinks, but there are no sources of sinks for net charge. Net charge in this room will increase or decrease if and only if some amount of charge will enter through one of the windows or the doors of this room. The boundaries of this room has to be crossed by charge if charge is to be changing in this room. Okay? Can be increasing or decreasing, that depends on whether the charge is exiting or entering, but that's the way it is. So there is a conservation equation concerning charge that takes this into account. Only and only transport plus storage, that is time rate of change and increase. And that's going to come from this equation. Okay, so now, be right, I1 minus I2 is not as necessarily equal to zero, because I1 and I2 are sometimes different, but in that case, this is dQ dt. And Q is the net amount of charge that is stored within that volume surrounded by S1 and S2. Okay, so let me now progress a little bit. And I'm going to associate I1 with a certain flux integral. I'm going to call that this is to be J dot dS1 integrated over surface S1. Now I'm talking about a current density that is in amperes per meter square, but that is being multiplied by what I am taking to be upward pointing surface area elements, and that gives me I1 in terms of a current density. And likewise, I'm going to write I2 as the integral, surface integral over S2 of J dot dS2, and dS2 is going to be taken also pointing upwards. So dS1 is pointing into the volume, but dS2 is pointing out of the volume. That is why I1 is the current going into the volume, and I2 is the exiting volume. Okay, so this is dS2. So that's how I can write I1 and I2. And this dQ dt, there is another way I can write this. I can write that to be the volume integral rather than a surface integral. It is the volume integral of d rho dt times volume element. And this is through the Encros volume. Okay? Are we all in agreement? This is sort of like we're going towards EM, from surface towards EM. Okay, so then, let me rearrange this equation. Let me take this term, put it on the other side, and let me take this term, put it on the other side too. So let me have an equation. The combination of three terms equals zero, some sort of a balance equation. So as I am doing that, this second term, as I transport to the other side, because there is a minus sign, it's going to add to the other side. But this guy is going to subtract. Okay? But I can make that term also add by making a change, okay? I can redefine my dS1 to be pointing outwards rather than inwards as I have. Then I can put a minus sign in front of it to compensate for that. And when I carry it to the other side, it's going to be plus. And then I can say, why am I wasting my time with surface 1 and surface 2? Surface 1 and surface 2 is generating a full complete circle. And now that I have switched the direction of dS1, every ds is pointing away from the circuit, I have one single surface integral to deal with. Okay? So I do all of that. Now my equation reads volume integral d rho dt dv plus now the combined two terms which came from the other side, and that is going to be the surface integral. Now I'm talking about a single surface, S. My S is really what used to be formally S1 and S2. Okay? And now ds, which is all pointing outwards, that is going to be equal j dot ds. And that's what I want to say. These two things are adding up, and that is equal to Jason by our arguments.
Zero.
Yeah, that is equal to this. This is one way of writing down the mathematical constraints regarding charge conservation. Charge doesn't out of the blue appear or disappear. Actually, of course, you may have a chamber and there is no charge whatsoever, no charge particle, and quantum mechanics allows you to have plus and minuses to come about at the same time. Or you can have a plus and a minus can come and they can annihilate themselves and they go away. But pay attention, they are always together. Net charge is not changing, okay? All right, so there's no sources and sets in that sense. This is my mathematical equation. So let me move this mathematical equation a little bit forward, okay? By divergence theorem, I can write this guy as a volume integral. Can you help me to write that equation as a volume integral? This is the divergence theorem. A surface integral representing a flux is equal volume integral of something of that same quantity, dV. What is that? Somebody. Say it. Divergence, yeah. Jim is saying that, hey, you can write this as a volume integral. This would be the volume integral. The surface is enclosing a volume. So because it's enclosing a volume, it is best to put this guy there. That reminds you us that it's a full complete surface that we are doing this integral. Inside is an enclosed volume. And for that enclosed volume, we have a divergence of J. And that multiplied by dV is equivalent to this by divergence theorem. Okay? Now that we see that, okay, then it is the sum of two volume integrals that equals zero. You can sort of like then say the argument of that, the integrand of that volume integral has to be equal to zero. You reach d rho dt plus divergence of j equal to zero. And this is the current continuity equation, or simply the continuity equation. And it has the standard mathematical structure of the conservation equations of all sorts of conserved quantities, with the exception that it is missing one possible additive element. It is missing here a sink or source term, okay? For energy, there is going to be ddt of the density of stored energy plus divergence of the energy transport factor, and that is called the divergence of the Poynting vector that you may remember from some other class, plus a source sink term, okay? And for energy, electromagnetic energy, that source sink term is going to be j dot e, okay? J dot e is very similar to v dot v times I. V times I is power. Is it, what is it? Well, it is either power that is dissipated or it is power that is produced. If Vi for a given circuit element is positive and V is the voltage drop in the direction of current flow, then that positive power is interpreted as what? Power absorbed or power delivered? Positive means it is power absorbed. But once in a while, in a circuit element, you follow all these rules and you find Vi is a negative quantity. Then you say, this element is actually not absorbing, but it is delivering power. That's why my number turned out to be negative. That negative is a signature of that. That's how you work on. Okay, so in an energy balance equation, we're going to have a similar sort of a conservation law, but there's going to be a J dot E in addition to the transport term. So storage term, transport term, plus a source sink term. In this case, there is no source sink. Okay? There are conservation laws like this all over the place. If you are doing fluid dynamics, there would be a continuity equation just like this that would be related to either mass conservation or the number density conservation of that neutral fluid that is flowing around. If you think about this, this is the linear combination of the number density conservation equations for positive charge carriers and negative charge carriers weighted by their sign, their charges, plus and minus. That's why the transport term ends up being a J. Very important equation. Okay, and it's hidden within Maxwell's equations. All right, so the guys in 1800s were all aware of this. They were smart people. And when Maxwell looked at this equation, he said, hey, if I take the divergence of both of these sides of the equation, I'm going to get zero here. Why is that? Because that's an identity, right? That's a vector identity. The divergence of the curl of anything is equal to zero. So 0 is equal to divergence of J, but I know that divergence of J is not necessarily equal to 0. What is really 0 is divergence of J plus d rho dt. Under all conditions, that combo is always 0. But divergence of J is equal to 0, that's not always correct. So probably this equation is not always correct. So he said, let me work with this equation. Let me modify it and see whether I can satisfy this equation and not be so incompatible with what Joule taught us, but maybe there are some other things that Joule might have missed. So he proposes, and remember, this H is, at least in free space microscopically, B divided by mu naught. Okay? So another way of writing this equation would be curl of B is equal to mu naught times J, or it's this way, in this fashion. Okay, so then he comes. Maxwell comes, says that, why don't I add to this J another thing that has to be in units of currents? And he decides to try out the following. Let's say that we try out epsilon naught times dE dt. Okay? Now, epsilon naught times E is equal to displacement. Therefore, time derivative of displacement is what he tried there. And he called this displacement current because it is coming from displacement. It must be displacement current. That's just the name. And then he was satisfied. Why? Because now if you take the divergence of both sides of this equation, then you fall into sort of a consistency with this equation if you use also one more thing, that is Gauss's law. Okay, so let's follow this. All right? So I take the divergence of both sides of this equation, left is equal to 0, and then I have divergence of J, and then I have basically epsilon naught, then ddt, I swap the divergence and ddt operators and go divergence of E. And what is divergence of E? Rho divided by? Okay, so this is, now I have divergence of E sitting here. But now I use Gauss's law and say, but divergence of E is simply rho divided by epsilon naught. My epsilon naught are going to cancel. I get 0 equals divergence of J plus ddt of rho. Aha, I'm okay. So basically, on a gut feeling that this equation has to be compatible with charge conservation, because that's a very, very important principle that never seems to be violated, Maxwell creates this equation. This is now the modified and correct form of Ampere's law. We sometimes call it still Ampere's law. Some other people say this is Ampere-Maxwell equation. Either way. Any questions? So while he was doing this, he was making some sort of unsafe assumptions, okay? When you say at this point divergence of E is equal rho divided by epsilon naught, you are tacitly assuming that Gauss's law, which was first constructed in the world of DC, is also valid as is in AC situation. Maybe that was not correct, but if that is correct, that is a correct assumption, and I have the full correct set of equations, I should be able to validate or not this equation. I should go to the lab, do some experiments, and see whether the predictions of these things are coming correct or not. If they didn't come correct, you would have to go and retry something else. It did turn out to be correct. Okay? What is the main prediction? The main prediction is, now if you write the full set of equations, that with the displacement current, you're going to have time-varying electric fields generating magnetic fields, quote-unquote. That's one way of looking at it, even if there is no J. So time-varying electric field generates time-varying magnetic field. And then you go to Faraday's law, which says time-varying magnetic field, again, in the same sense, is generating time-varying electric fields. Now you have a complete feedback loop, okay? So sort of like time-varying electric fields are responsible for time-varying magnetic fields. Time-varying magnetic fields are responsible for time-varying electric fields. There's a bootstrap situation. You can actually propagate these waves in the absence of anything. Basically, E rides on B, B rides on E in vacuum, okay? Although that's a sort of a very modern way of looking at it, and it wasn't fully appreciated even by Maxwell. Maxwell were thinking that these waves Okay, so what are the equations? Let's write the full set of equations in one form. Divergence of E is equal to rho divided by epsilon naught. For the moment, I'm relapsing back to the microscopic form or the free space form. We will go back to the medium form shortly. And then there is the divergence of B is equal to zero. And then there is the curl of E, which is minus dVdt. And then now I'll write the curl of H, which is a curl of B, let's write it. And that is mu naught times J plus mu naught times epsilon naught dEdt. Okay? This is current density of charges moving around. This is a slightly more mysterious current density. It is actually time-varying electric field. It's not a current density, but it appears in the position of a current density, so you might as well effective current density, all right? And now, if you are in vacuum, this is zero, but you still have curl of E and curl of B non-zero because of time-varying fields, okay? A time-varying electric field generates a B. That B is also time-varying, it generates an E, which is also time-varying, back and forth, back and forth. This is the wave equation. Wave, if you do the math of this, two, three lines, you get a wave equation. That was the equation on the backside of my t-shirt the first day, and the solution of that are propagating waves. That was the prediction, and the prediction was confirmed. Okay, but of course, like Maxwell must have had very good feeling that it was going to get confirmed, because not only do you get a wave equation, you get a wave equation that is indicating waves propagating with the speed of light, and that is not a coincidence probably. Okay, if everything is, if this universe is in fair in some sense, God has created the universe in a fair sense, he would have just arranged it like that. There would be, if some waves are propagating at the speed of light and other things are also propagating at the speed of light, probably they are one and the same thing to a certain extent. There is some unification. Okay, any questions here? So that's our full set of Maxwell's equations with Maxwell's contributions. Most of these equations, as I said, came from experiments. Careful experiments turned into math. Finally, Maxwell's contribution was more on a theoretical bent. And there they are. Still though, they are not derived set of equations. They are math fitted to observations, basically. Although these days, after learning many other things in the 20th century, there are ways of deriving these equations from some more fundamental principles, okay? And that is very comforting. Some symmetry principles can be utilized to actually derive these equations. Even if you never went to a lab and derived experiments, you were just like a theoretician, can't touch any equipment, but a good one. You could, in principle, come up with this set of equations. Any questions? All right, so what do we want to do next? Let me look at my notes. So I want to turn, basically, we reached this equation using Gauss's law and charge conservation. Okay, you can turn around the argument. Say, suppose you know this, okay? You can derive from this equation, if you know that charges conserve, this equation. Therefore, in some sense, this equation is secondary in importance to this equation. Just take the divergence of this equation on both sides, use charge conservation, you stumble into this equation, okay? In the same way, if you take the divergence of this equation, then divergence of curl of E is equal to zero. Therefore, you reach the conclusion dDt of the divergence of B is equal to zero. If that is the case, divergence of B cannot be a time-varying quantity. That's what it says. If it's not a time-varying quantity, what is that non-time-varying quantity? 5, 6, 7? Well, it's zero. It's zero because we have never seen divergence anywhere. It's not going to change in time, and we haven't seen it anywhere to be other than zero. If this argument is saying that if it was other than zero, then it would not be changing and sticking there, okay? But we only observe it in the absence of any observational divergence, we have to set that to equal to zero, okay? Now, if there were magnetic, and all this implies that there is no such thing as magnetic monopoles, but if there were magnetic monopoles, that argument wouldn't be correct, and we would have to add a few more terms into Maxwell's equations, and that they would have to be A related to the existence of a magnetic charge. So there would be a magnetic charge density that would be going accompanying this equation. And we would add another term to this equation, and that would have to be the transport of magnetic charge generating magnetic currents. That's what it means. Okay? And then you would say that dvdt term in the Faraday's law is sort of like a displacement current counterpart of this more complicated situation. Now, at the Big Bang, right after the Big Bang, some of the theorists indicate that there were magnetic monopoles, but they just disappeared in the right aftermath of that Big Bang. There was an inflation period, the universe expanded really fast, and things disappeared. Nowadays, we don't seem to have this magnetic monopole. But every now and then, you'll see a physics paper saying, hey, in the lab, we have, in a high energy situation, we have created a magnetic monopole. But most of these things turn, well, I haven't seen any result that stuck. Let's put it this way. Anyway, so that's where we are. These are our equations. Now, let's turn them into equations that are more practical in situations where we have a lot of bound charge carriers. Right now, our rho and our j has to account for every charge there is. Okay? All right? But that is microscopic sort of a point of view, but most of the time we are in situations in the vicinities of things in which there is a lot of charges, but most of them are bound, and we would like to do what we did, like we're going from epsilon naught, we went to epsilon. We want to repeat that idea, but now we want to repeat that into also including magnetic effects into account. We have only done that with respect to polarization and electric fields at epsilon, but we need to do something like that also with respect to the current. So let me just do that. Okay, so this rho is all the rho that I can think of. Okay, therefore, it is the rho of free charges. There's a whole bunch of charges that are flying around. They are not parts of atoms and molecules. Those are free charge carriers, and there is a rho associated with that. And then there is a rho associated with bound charge carriers. And that, do you guys remember what was that? That was the negative divergence of some quantity.
Polarization.
Yes, exactly. That is the term we call minus divergence of P to be the bound charge density. And actually, we transported that term to the other side of Gauss's law to combine divergence of P with epsilon, with the divergence of epsilon naught times E, and call that whole thing epsilon naught E plus PD. That was our displacement. Okay, so. Thus, we're not going to do anything different than that. Say, this is the total charge density. And we are just about to take this guy and put it on the other side. Okay? We will do what we did before. Now, and then the other source term is sitting right here. I have the current density. This is the total current density. The current that is carried by the free charges that are moving around relative to one another, plus bound charges that are sort of dancing around one another, and however they are doing it, they are creating some sort of a current density. So given that, I write this guy as J sub F for free charge carriers. Now for bound charge carriers, what should I write? Do bound charges, do they generate currents? We talked about this. We talked about a polarization current several lectures ago. And what was my physical picture? When I have an atom that is stretched out, now it creates a dipole, but this dipole, if it's changing as a function of time, dp dt, indicates relative motion of microscopic charges with respect to one another. And when we did that in lecture, I don't remember, 10 or something like that, we said that polarization current density is equal to, somebody look up, Alex, you know. Do you remember? Polarization current density. It is in terms of P, and what is it? Somebody. Do you know what I'm talking about? Do you know about polarization? You know about that, right?
Yeah.
You stretch an atom, now pluses and minuses are separate, they form a dipole.
Right.
But if whatever is stretching this thing is time varying, so that stretch is time varying, then this thing is going back and forth. An electric field is stretching it this way, but you have an AC electric field, then the stretch is going to then go the opposite direction and then come back and separate in a periodic fashion. That represents the motion of a charge with respect to another charge, right? Isn't that a current? It is a current, AC current, that can be supported by bound charge carriers. And that was, now somebody can tell me. It's in your notes. You. You're sitting there and I want an effort. What is the polarization current? Now I can ask Jim, he will give the answer, but I don't want to ask Jim. He's a, after all, an old-timer physicist. You guys are protesting me by not answering? You, Sam, right?
Huh? I don't have the notes.
You don't have the notes? You don't remember? Okay, I'll remind you guys. So, some of you guys have this in your telephones, I know. What is it? It's VPDT. Remember? Remember, Sam? Yeah. Now, incidents like this sometimes burn these types of things in people's minds. Okay? You don't know it, but probably from now on, most of you guys who have been paying attention to this particular portion of the lecture, you're going to remember it. Okay? And physically, Sam, does it make sense? Physically, it does. It's that picture that I showed you. Okay? See, remember, in that lecture, we wrote down a second-order differential equation, the solution of which gave the displacement of the electron from the atom under a certain model. This was the Lorentz group model. We got the P because we got R, the displacement of the electron from the ion. We got an equation for that, okay? And that gave us the little p, which was the displacement times E, and then minus E, to tell the truth, okay? And then we considered n of them per unit volume, and that gave us the model for big P. And we see that big P is proportional to electric field that stretches the thing, okay? Then we say, but if that R is changing as a function of time, the RdT, that will be a charge moving. You know, current density is nothing but a charge times the velocity it has with respect to another charge. So if the current is going to be proportional to the RdT, okay, when you take into account all the proportionality factors, it becomes the dpdt, that is the curve, that is the AC curve. Okay, so I reminded you guys that. Now, is this all? Is this, now, yes?
When we consider the curl of what is...
We are going to consider it now, okay? I am claiming that this is not the only bound charge related current, okay? This is a sort of, this goes hand in hand with the generation of a charge density. A bound charge density is being generated because of this, okay? So this is a type of a bound charge current that is non-divergent. That is divergent, sorry, I told the wrong thing. Because it is divergent, it is giving rise to charge density. Now, where do I know? Well, I know that sort of from this equation, okay? My continuity equation says that if I have a divergence for any j, there is going to be a corresponding time variation of the charge density, okay? So this equation actually applies to all of the charges, bound as well as free, okay? So if we apply it to bound charge densities, and if the bound charge density current is here, then this j is dpdt, okay, and that is going to be associated with the generation of this guy so that everything sums up to zero. Okay, so Sam, coming back to the physical picture, when I have my charges going back and forth, the stretch charges, okay, they are also generating a corresponding charge density through this accumulated force. Now, this type of a current, you can imagine, is going to generate charge density because current goes and stops and comes back. There is a momentary, sort of like capacitive situation, okay? So given that, there is an associated charge density. But I can also imagine the existence of currents that are never generating any divergence. These would be the kind of currents that are associated motions which are making loops. They don't ever stop. They don't have to stop, slow down, come back. They go boom, boom, boom around. And therefore, they are divergence-free. How can I add a divergence-free current here? But why don't I just add something that has a zero divergence? And what is that? Any field that I can generate by taking the curl of a certain field is going to be automatically divergence free. Okay? So then I say, to be complete, I'm going to write here this guy. I'm somebody did this before me. I learned it from my teachers, okay? But basically somebody said, hey, to write the most general form of the sum of free and bound charges, I have to consider here a loss term that goes as the curl of M. And this is what this Alice was asking moments ago. Okay? So then what is this related to? Well, it is related to, microscopically, it's a bound charges carrying loop currents. Where might be such loop currents associated with bound charges? Now, polarization has to do with stretching back and forth. Okay? But you also have some notion of how an atom works. Maybe our easiest notion is the planetary system picture, which is quantum mechanically wrong, but at least it indicates that there are charges turning around and creating. Okay, quantum mechanically, maybe this is not the most accurate picture, but quantum mechanics doesn't say that there are no, okay, currents that are at the microscopic level associated with the motions of the charges other than polarization. And this is what it's captured there. Okay, so I talked a lot. Okay, it's time now to simplify things. How am I going to simplify things? I'm going to simplify things as follows. First, I will multiply this epsilon naught. I will get rid of putting epsilon naught on this side, and I will take minus divergence of P, bring it to the other side, and I'm going to write, let me now finish what I'm writing. I'm going to now here write divergence of epsilon naught times E plus P polarization is equal to free charge density. That's my first equation. My Gauss's law has been transformed. And I will decide from here on, as we did before, to call this guy displacement D. Okay? And that will be, in short, for linear systems, for linear media, it's going to, P is going to be epsilon times E, where epsilon is epsilon R times epsilon R. Okay, Jason? So that's business number one. The second equation, divergence of P equals zero, that didn't change. Okay? The third equation, Faraday's law, that didn't change either. Okay? So curl of E is equal to minus dB dt. Okay? The last equation changed profoundly because there is a lot of work to be done here. First, I'm going to divide both sides of this equation by mu naught, and let me write the resulting equation over here. I'm going to have curl of B divided by mu naught. What else am I going to do? Okay, so then that creates a curl of M that is sitting here, no longer multiplied by mu naught because mu naught has been transported to the other side. I can transport, because it has a curl on top of it, I prefer it to come to the left-hand side, and if it comes to the left-hand side, it is going to be an M here because the curl is being taken, okay? What's left on the other side? On the other side is left, first, my free charge, free current density. This is the current density, amperes per meter square, that is conducted by those unbound electrons and ions, whatever they are. All right? What else is left? I also have dP dt to contend with, and I have this guy to represent. I can combine them in this following fashion. There is evidently a ddt of epsilon naught times E plus P. That's my last equation. Now, just like I noticed that I have a D sitting there, I have a D sitting here. Okay? From now on, I will write this side as J sub F, plus the displacement current, which is simply the time derivative of the displacement. And if you ask me, what is that displacement? Well, it's epsilon times electric field. If you dig even further, it is epsilon naught times E plus whatever the polarization is. That is what displacement is. And the displacement current, it is time derivative of P. Okay? So then I'm going to do something else. I'm going to call this guy and give it a name H. Okay? This M, did you ask about M? You asked something?
No.
No question. Okay? So you might say, what is the names for this? Well, M is called simply called magnetization. Okay, its curl gives you the looping currents inside the materials, and you might have to go and do some physics to model it from first principles, like we modeled the polarization from first principles several lectures ago using the Lorentz root method. I'm not going to attempt this with respect to magnetization, because a classical Lorentz root type of an approach to come up with a plausible physical picture what M is very difficult. It doesn't work out. There is a lot of quantum mechanics associated with magnetic material response. Okay, so that has to be done quantum mechanics wise. So if you don't like, if you're not a physicist, if you don't want to do it this way, go to the lab. Go to the lab and learn about your mu's and relationship between B's and H's we are just about to establish over there through experimental means. Okay, so I'm going to come to that in a few moments. So then our H matches this guy. Okay, so why don't I then get, so let me do it step by step. B divided by mu naught minus M is equal to H. So let me multiply both sides of this equation with mu naught and transport M to the other side. So then we have this equation reading B is equal to mu naught times H plus M. Okay, this M is there because there are bound charge carriers. The bound charge carriers are there because there is material. If there were no material, there would be no atoms and molecules, there would be no M. In vacuum, there is no M. Okay, but in material media, there would be M. Okay, now, then, what is, and as I promised moments ago, we are not going to derive the M from first principles. But I may at least do the following. I might say that I presume that there's going to be materials in which this M is linearly dependent on the excitation, okay? I'm going to presume that there exists a constant which is called magnetic susceptibility, sigma sub M, that multiplies H and gives us M, okay? Then the physics is in deriving sigma sub M from first principles. And that is hard to do classically, but it can be done quantum mechanically, or you measure it in the lab, in a sense. So we are almost done. So why? Because now, after this substitution, I can write, let me come here and get rid of this old version of continuity equation that no longer is needed. Okay, I can write that equation as B equals mu naught times 1 plus magnetic susceptibility times H. And then I can decide to call this mu sub R, and then call this whole thing mu. So now we have generated a similar sort of approach as we had when we were dealing with electrical materials, dielectrics. There we came up with D equals epsilon E, that epsilon was epsilon naught times epsilon R was 1 plus electric susceptibility. It's the whole same thing, okay, this time around. But we are not going to derive chi sub M from first principles. Any questions? Okay, we're not going to derive chi sub m from first principles, but I can give you some facts, okay? For a vast number of materials that are sitting around, like this wood or this glass, that chi sub m is a number that is super small compared to unity, okay? So small that it doesn't all that matter all that much, okay? But there are two classes of super small chi sub m's compared to unity. Some are positive, some are negative, okay? If you are in a material where chi sub m is an incredibly small negative number, then you call those materials diamagnetic materials, okay? Glass and wood are diamagnetic materials, okay? If you have a magnet and you come next to that diamagnetic material, there is no interaction, there is no pull and push that you can detect. Actually there is one. There is a very, very, very slight push, repulsion, okay? But you are unable to detect that because it's such a small effect. Alternatively, there is another class of materials for which chi sub m is positive, but very small to compare to 1. So the whole thing, mu sub r, is for all practical purposes still 1, but it is slightly bigger than 1. And these are paramagnetic materials. Aluminum is an example. Tungsten is an example. Again, you go to these materials with a permanent magnet, you touch it, you feel like there is no interaction, there is no pull or push. You cannot detect there is actually a very, very, very slight pull. Those are paramagnetic materials. And then there are these materials that you are familiar with, like your refrigerator door, which interacts incredibly strongly with magnetic fields, and these are the ferromagnetic materials, okay? They have very large positive chi sub m. Any questions? Actually, situation gets sort of like complicated with those kinds of materials, and there is a sort of this linearity assumption. Here was an assumption. I'm assuming that this M is linearly proportional to H. That was an assumption. For ferromagnetic materials, that assumption is not so good, okay? There is a nonlinear response, and there is even this so-called hysteresis effect, okay? if we summarize all this stuff ultimately into B equals mu times H equation, which is a linear relationship, if all the assumptions are correct, as B is increasing, H is increasing. They are following one another. But with materials such as ferromagnetic materials, iron, and so forth, if you follow what is going on, as B and H are increasing, they are not increasing at the same rate. That is a deviation from linearity. And then when you start decreasing them, you don't visit exactly the same previous values that you had while you were increasing B and H. You start with B and H equal to zero. You put a current in some vicinity that creates B and H simultaneously. Then you see, as you are increasing the current, how these quantities are increasing. But as you decrease the current, they don't go back the same way, okay? In your Rao's book, there is a one or two page section on this material that I want you to read. There is a hysteresis curve. Professor Rao plots there B versus H. H is on one axis, B is on the other axis. He has a figure like this, okay? Please read this discussion. It's a good discussion over there, okay? You start with unmagnetized material, B equals zero, H is equal to zero, but then you apply some current, you raise both of them. Then you decrease the current, and you reach a situation where this point is very important. H is reduced back to zero because you have reduced the exciting currents, the external currents, but B is not equal to zero. Where is that B coming from? That B is coming from the internal currents, the atomic level currents that have been organized by this entire procedure. This is how they make permanent magnets. You take an iron, expose it to a large current, you increase its magnetization, and then you decrease the current and leave in a state that is acting like a permanent magnet. All right? So what are these? These are pieces of iron in which all the atomic level currents are circulating in a sort of in agreement direction, and they are acting like source of a magnetic field. They become like one of those current loops. Remember, you put two of them, they either push one another or they pull one another, depending whether the currents are going in the same direction or the opposite direction. A picture that we had several lectures ago, okay? So that's how they make these things. Okay, but this stuff really is complicated, okay? If you want to study this really well, you should be a physicist, you should be a material scientist, etc., okay? We electrical engineers don't necessarily pay attention to all such details. We just use them. We are pragmatic people. If you can use it, good. Let somebody else explain the details. Any questions? So there we are. What else do I want to talk about today? Now, you can certainly finish your homework. So I ran out of stuff to say. Should we go? We covered several lectures here. So we were one day behind. Today's topic was this. Okay, so I caught up. I covered two lectures today. I'm going real fast, as I did. Paramagnetic, diamagnetic, etc. So what's next? Wave equation. Let's do this tomorrow. We are ready. We are now ready to do the fun stuff. This is what electrical engineers do. Power engineers, of course, know everything that we've finished, but the real proof is that we're going to do the stuff that we're going to be doing. Okay, regrade requests.